I'm Dr. Blair Williams. I am a lecturer in Australian politics at Monash University, and I'm a branch committee member for the Monash branch of the NTU. So I go to the fortnightly committee meetings and help organise campaigns, and I'm also NTU delegate for the School of Social Sciences as well. So I'm that person around the office who is the union person and updates my colleagues about all the union going-ons and whatnot.
Well, we brought you here to talk to our audience today, Blair, because Monash University has been making some pretty sweeping changes, or they're planning on making some pretty sweeping changes to staffing in the coming year. The NETU has described that these changes are in response to, quote, a bad faith interpretation of the government's recent changes to the Closing the Loopholes legislation. Would you be able to explain for us what these changes to legislation actually look like and what Monash's proposed changes look like as well?
So the Closing the Loopholes Act, basically it came in end of August, and it provides a new definition of casual employee and employment via these kind of new rules. So, for example, that a casual employee is entitled to casual loading, as well as factors to be considered in determining casual employment. So a casual worker shouldn't have, you know, regular work every week, because that isn't casual. That should be, you know, permanent work. Mm-hmm. And it specifies that universities still remain entitled to employ casual, performing genuinely casual work. And so that's the change there, is rather than just casual work that's ambiguous, it's genuinely casual work. And that's including irregular and intermittent work. And as I said before, casual employees who are performing indefinite work should be able to access more secure work via, for example, wins in our NTU enterprise bargaining agreement. And also it's brought in the rule that if anyone has been in their role as a casual for more than 6 months, they are entitled to ask for a conversion mm-hmm. to permanent work. But universities around Australia, but especially Monash University, have taken this to mean that we can't hire casuals at all unless it's in, you know, very much irregular, intermittent work, that we can't, you know, have casual tutors, that we can't do casuals in those kinds of ways. And therefore, we are seeing basically the removal of most casual teaching next year and replacement by a few different kind of contracts. So one is a PhD teaching fellow contract, and that has been around this year, although much to the chagrin of many, many do not like it, because it's a fractional contract for PhD candidates. And the fraction is basically too tiny. It's either a 0.1 or a 0.2 teaching load, which basically means teaching 1 to 2 tutorials a week for either $150 or around $300 a week, depending on what your load is. Mm-hmm. And the job is tied to their candidature. So if they take a break from their PhD, they lose their job. And there's also obviously no casual loading because they're not casuals, but they can access, in replacement of that, a tiny pro rata leave accrual. But again, because their load is so low, it takes forever to accrue that leave.
Mm-hmm.
They also have the CDPAE contracts, which is a very long way of saying continuing defined period academic employment contract. And that is basically means where the work is undertaken during a defined teaching period. And outside of those periods, you don't get work and you don't get paid. And the EBA specifies, you know, to be 40 weeks a year minimum, but the university has declared a 40-week cap, even though it can technically go higher. They've refused.
Wow.
And it can be a 0.6 minimum, but it can go higher than that. But it seems like a lot of them will be 0.6. And so unlike, say, my role as a lecturer, where I'm a 40-40-20, which means 40% of my job is teaching, 40% of my job is research, and 20% is service, these CDPAE contracts are teaching intensive. So 90% of their load is teaching, and that looks like a lot of teaching. It means they can take on up to 12 two-hour tutorials a week, and therefore marking up to 120 hours in a fortnight during those marking periods, and that's in addition to their in-person teaching loads as well. So basically, though these sound great in terms of, you know, more security and permanency, because they are permanent continuing roles, the university has sadly made these roles as exploitative as possible, so that, you know, you spend 3 months of the year not getting paid, so that you're teaching massive amounts that is, you know, unfeasible to the human body. And it's just really not great in terms of that. So, you know, long story short, they're getting rid of casuals as we know it. We also still don't know what casual work will look like next year. We have the CDPAE contracts, the teaching fellows for the PhDs. And we have, from what we've heard about casual roles, is that if they are there, they'll be around two-week marking contracts where they'll be marking courses they've never taught in and students they don't know. They could be backup tutors for sick tutors, and they can be facilitators during workshops. But these roles would only be paid around $50 an hour being in the classroom, and they won't be paid for any work outside of class, so no pay for doing the readings or watching the lectures as tutors usually get. And therefore, tutor rate is, I think, it's around $150+ an hour. So this is very much a pay cut in that sense, mm-hmm. because they're not being paid for their extra work.
It's pretty shocking.
Yeah, not great.
No, not great. In terms of kind of in classrooms, what will these types of changes look like?
It depends, because this is going to look differently in different areas, in different faculties, but also in different schools within the same faculty. So some areas of, say, the Faculty of Art, not much is changing aside from the fact that there'll be less courses to take. So, you know, because there are less tutors, it means that continuing staff will have to make up those gaps, which means obviously less continuing staff to be able to teach different courses. Other areas are instead keeping all the same courses but massively increasing class sizes. So instead of a normal tutorial, which since the onset of the COVID pandemic has been around 30 students per tutorial, prior to that it was around 20 to 25. But even that would look tiny in comparison to the so-called workshops they're proposing, which would have around 75 plus students each for these two-hour so-called workshops, with one tutor and maybe a facilitator as a helping hand. But again, those facilitators haven't been paid to do the readings or watch the lecture, so they won't know much about the content. And if they do, that is unpaid work that they've done. So as you can imagine, this is all pretty terrible for student education, because they risk being marked by people they haven't met and who don't know them and don't know the course. They risk being taught in giant class sizes, or they risk not having the variety of courses that they'd previously signed up for. So it's just really terrible for education and for students. And that, I think, is why so many staff members, including myself, are so angry about this and so worried about it, is because of the impact this is having on students who, I remind you, you know, many of those art students next year will be paying $50,000 for their degrees.
I'm one of those art students, actually, Blair. I'm one of those art students, actually, Blair.
Yeah, exactly. So I remind you, reminding listeners, it's just terrific.
And when I started my degree, it was just as Scott Morrison made changes to the fees for arts degrees in particular. So just at the beginning of my degree, fees increased by... increased by 113%. And so art students are literally paying more than law students, someone doing medicine.
Your money is going to fund those courses that are more expensive, basically, because your courses are not that expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's disastrous. It's an intellectual attack.
Yes. I think that's a great segue to talking about what this kind of means, or what this is signalling about the role or kind of service Monash University understands itself to be playing in our Melbourne community, but in our Australian community, and also in kind of the broader university sector as a whole. I think most people would like to think that universities are there to provide a public good. It's an educational service. To me, a lot of these changes would suggest that isn't really what they're there to provide, or at least Monash isn't thinking that that's their main priority. What do you think this suggests about the role that they're actually playing in our communities?
I'm with you in that I think it should play a beneficial role in the community. It should help educate people, students, you know, everyone, which on its own benefits our society, because that knowledge, you know, helps improve everything. And, you know, we see at this time in particular with rising misinformation and disinformation, rising fascism, the rise of AI, it is more important than ever to have the ability to critically think and analyse and understand the world around us and understand the history before us so we don't repeat its mistakes. And that's why I got into education. I want to, you know, help make change in those ways. But it seems that university management, and again, I separate management from workers because I think the workers are on our side with that. But the management and the politicians and the kind of dominant narrative is that they are job-making factories. I mean, why do you think it's called Jobs Ready Graduates? They want to use this ideology to get certain people into universities and produce certain graduates that will therefore, as you know, the thinking goes, have that economic impact to make money for corporations and, you know, to just be good job-ready graduates. So depressing.
I think also, sorry to interrupt you, but I think it would also be worth talking about what university administrators are getting out of universities as they currently exist.
I think if we look at administrators, and again, I can't presume to know what they think, but it does seem like they are applying that kind of private corporate sector mentality to these institutions of learning, you know, these public institutions. They're applying that kind of profit over education mentality And that's what we're seeing here, you know. Universities around the country, especially the governance in these universities, being, you know, critiqued quite widespread by academics and by some in the media for being too focused on profit and for being extremely exploitive of its staff. And it really does, I guess, erode the core purpose of the university there. And it's really depressing to see, as I said, universities have a really important role in our society. But these bad faith decisions that the university management has made is to reduce the quality of education and also to increase staff exploitation. And all of that decreases our ability to provide that quality education, and both the staff and the students suffer. But I think also our society suffers with it.
I'd just like to point out to our listeners as well that NetU this year reported that 97,000 university staff have suffered a collective $159 million in wage theft across the country. So clearly this is an issue of pretty substantial scale at this point. I think we might have talked about this before we were recording, but this is kind of a university sector-wide problem. It's happening internationally. It's happening across Australia at different universities. Why is it the case that this is such a widespread problem?
I think there are several factors. And one, I mean, if you're talking about the international context, it seems to be ideological on that level, especially against the arts and especially against the humanities and social sciences. It seems to be an ideological attack on this kind of, you know, critical thinking and critical analysis that we see provided in those degrees, especially in those degrees. If you look towards the US, God forbid, all the attacks in the last few years on critical race theory and feminism and queer rights and anything to do with woke culture, as they call it, and I'm using my fingers as quote marks here, sarcastic quote marks, it kind of shows, it to be an ideological thing. Because, I mean, Jobs Ready Graduates, for example, failed in terms of the intentions of the program. It was to try to get more students into STEM and less students in art, thinking that students can be persuaded by, you know, cheaper degrees. So that's not how it works. You know, students, there are just some students who want to do the arts, and that's great. But also, it was premised on the idea that STEM graduates make more money and have greater job security. But that's also patently false, and there's a lot of research showing that's false, that the arts graduates are actually really valuable, if we're talking in the economic sense here, because the skills you learn in one and develop from one are so flexible, and they can be used in various roles. Whereas, for example, someone, you know, graduating with engineering or something a bit more precise like that, it's really geared up to a certain job and therefore is less varied in that sense. So that's why arts graduates have great job outcomes, is because, again, they can be used in many different fields and many different jobs. So it's very much alive, but they don't have great job outcomes from finishing their degree. So the whole premise of that is therefore false, and which implies that it is ideological. It's based on the idea that we value arts less, or that, you know, the government at the time valued these arts degrees less. And you're seeing it, as I said, in the US, you're seeing it in the UK, similar attacks on the arts being made there. And it's not surprising if you look at the politics of it, in that an educated populace is a more dangerous populace for governments in a way. And for people who can critically think, they therefore can critically think the ways out of, you know, some of the propaganda that politicians want to put forward. And they can also make connections with the past and the present, and they can be more informed citizens in that way. So it really is a threat to power. I mean, as the old adage goes, you know, knowledge is power, and we can very much see it in universities, and therefore we can see that it's being perceived as a threat.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to talking about the role that staff have played in these types of changes, has the university included university staff in the process of thinking about these types of changes to the faculty and to staffing? Have staff actually been consulted at all?
I would love to say yes. Not really. So continuing academic staff like myself were told about these changes back in late September, but there wasn't much clarity. Even those above us, heads of schools and even deans, didn't really have heaps of clarity in terms of what this is going to look like. And this is despite knowing that, you know, the changes to the closing the loopholes, I think we've been given a two-year warning by the government, so we knew 2 years ago, and yet it was basically in the week that it happened that the universities were like, oh no, what do we do? And they proceeded to, you know, run around like a chicken with a head cut off. And so we were told about it, but the casuals weren't. And we asked several people in these different meetings, asked about, you know, whether casuals will be notified about this, and we were told that eventually, but not yet. And so the union decided to tell the casuals about this because they have to make plans for next year, you know. Some casuals, for example, some casuals in my class, in my course, had been teaching it for 10 years, and they depended on this work. They have kids, and they all depend on this work. And so to not tell them until the last minute is pretty horrific. So there was a bit of consultation again with the continuing, but that process was basically non-existent, and it was pretty murky. We also do not have a say over how these changes will be enacted. We're told what will happen. And oftentimes, as I said, the information is last minute and also a bit opaque. And casual staff have not been consulted at school, aside from what the union has told them and what some course conveners like myself have told our tutors at the time. And also the process for hiring the CDP AE contract has been quite disastrous, according to some of our members who are going through it. And again, they haven't really been consulted on this prior to the process, but those who've received interviews have said that pretty ad hoc in a way, and it seems to be quite rushed. And some places around the university, they didn't even interview people for these contracts, and people instead just got tapped on the shoulder and offered a position. So it's pretty ramshackled in that way. Again, because I think we didn't receive enough time and weren't consulted properly enough to do these processes properly.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's obviously a pretty significant rift occurring between the interests and preferences of people who are actually staff at the universities, people who are actually realistically they're providing the service that people are paying mm-hmm. for, and what university administrators seem to be interested in doing. What's going on in terms of the power that university employees actually have within these institutions? Do they have the power to assert their interests, would you say?
I started working in universities in 2016, so I'm pretty fresh in this. So I listened to some of my colleagues who've been around since the 90s, some even since the 70s and 80s, and it's really interesting to hear the history of what our departments looked like and the agency that these departments used to have. And so basically, power has been centralized, especially in the last decade or two. It used to be decentralized so that each department and school had agency and our own budgets and could have our own decision-making and, you know, really had that kind of control there. Because, again, it's our area. We know best what should happen in our area and we would ensure that that would happen. Whereas now it's been centralized and we have very little say in what actually happens. Oftentimes it's top-down hierarchy. We're told from on high what is going to happen, if we are told at all. And this is not just a Monash thing. This is, around the country, many universities have moved to this way of decision making. So management or the executive hold all the power and agency. Like, for example, the Monash University Council only has a single academic elected representative and one student representative.
Mm-hmm.
And many on that council aren't academics at all, but are from the corporate sector. And again, this is similar to other universities around the country also. But it's pretty horrific that, academics, there are thousands of us at Monash, and we only have a single rep. Considering, for example, an academic from the arts is very different to an academic from the sciences, we should have mm-hmm. obviously more than one representative there. Individually, we're allowed to assert our interests. We're allowed to join the union. We're not allowed to be discriminated against by being in the union or by taking, protected action or by talking about union issues and that kind of stuff. It's in line with the enterprise bargaining agreement, mm-hmm. but this is obviously easier done if you have tenure. Even then, people can still experience ramifications like being looked over for promotion or being ostracized. You hear stories of these things happening throughout the last few years around the country. And again, if you don't have a secure job, then it's much harder to assert your interest there. And so we have a lot of casuals, for example, that wanted to participate in the wage theft case that we had, was it 2 weeks ago? And they wanted to talk to the media, but they felt unsafe to do so because they were currently being interviewed for those CDP AE contracts. And they were mm-hmm. fearful that if they did this, if they showed their face in the media, then they would be not hired for those contracts. So again, precarity is the death of academic freedom. So technically we have the right, but in practice it's a lot more complex.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting there that you've highlighted, the importance of contract arrangements in creating a bit more stability around your staff members' ability to assert their interests and preferences. Mm-hmm. And that is obviously what's most fundamentally under attack in these changes. So the NTU is not taking these changes lying down, it seems. You've been holding protests on campus. How successful have those protests been in terms of making some progress around this? Have you seen any success?
It's hard to say. I think there's been a lot of progress here and some successes, and also there's still a long way to fight also. So I think a success is that we've forcibly drawn management's attention to the issue, and even though they haven't engaged in widespread formal consultation yet, we have seen some movement in that regard. So we've had meetings with HR, for example, who've talked to some of us about this, though have been the most productive yet. There are still some more meetings to be had. We also had a protest on campus where the Vice Chancellor, Sharon Pickering, was speaking to the Faculty of Arts, and a lot of casuals and people in that arts organising space protested that event, and therefore the Vice Chancellor had to hear the concerns that they were talking about. So it's good to get this out in the open, to speak about it freely, to show management that staff are drastically unhappy, and mm-hmm. to ensure that these conversations are being had and they can't sweep us under the rug. We're also in the progress of trying to organise the different workplaces around the campus, and this kind of grassroots campaign that did originate in arts has spread beyond the faculty, and we're seeing more pushback on these issues in other faculties as well, which is fantastic to see. So we're seeing a bigger grassroots movement rather than a top-down, you know, leader-led movement in the union. And therefore, yeah, no, it's great to see, because this is what the unions are about. You know, it's about the workers. The workers are the union. And so we're seeing a branch that is more engaged and more organized. And we're also extremely well positioned to start the new year fighting for better conditions within these new roles. The new roles that have been proposed for next year, the CDPAEs, the PhD fellows, we're positioned well to fight for the better conditions for those people, and also to continue to fight for the rights of casuals, whatever that's going to look like next year, those casual roles. And I think most importantly, we're fired up. Our members are more active, they're more engaged, they're angry about what's happening, to both for themselves, but especially for our students. And we're also seeing a lot more student engagement as well. For example, the student evaluation surveys I received for my course this semester, many of the qualitative comments talked about how much they love these smaller class sizes and how much they're dreading those bigger ones, because they say it's not conducive to good learning. So we're seeing, yeah, student engagement there. And I think students should be fighting alongside us. It's not just affecting staff, it's affecting both staff and students. And so it's us against management. And that makes me hopeful for our fight next year.
Really glad to hear that you're making some positive differences in the face of what seems like pretty insurmountable pressure from higher ups.
Yeah. Yep.
As a final question, Blair, you're a political scientist by trade. I thought this could be a good moment to kind of connect what's going on in the university sector to kind of what's going on more broadly in society at the moment. I think you've already mentioned some ongoing social changes that have been increasing more rapidly recently, for instance, the rise of fascism. Do you have any reflections about what these kinds of changes and the experiences of Monash staff have to tell us about power more broadly, how power works, and particularly how power works in the workplace?
I think these fights we're seeing happening at Monash are not only happening at other universities, as we've talked about, but are happening around our society as well. We're seeing a rise in the union movement, which is great to see, and we're seeing a rise in exploitation. Perhaps that's why the union movement is rising, because we are seeing, in a cost of living crisis, seeing, workers continue to be exploited and further exploited, whether that's being forced back into the workplace post the normalisation of actually flexible work during the earlier stages of the COVID pandemic. We're seeing, the erosions of rights like that. We're seeing stagnating wages, and we're seeing corporate exploitation of our societies. And so I think it really does show what is happening there, or I guess reflect what is happening in the world around us, and the kind of, I guess, the fight between the worker and the boss. And that is an age-old fight, right? Nothing new there. But we have seen a weakening of unions in the last 40 years or so since the onset of neoliberalism. And so as a political scientist, we love the term neoliberalism. But bringing it back to the idea, where the free market is prioritised, where the economic system depends on worker exploitation, and I guess the ideology goes that we should have smaller governments and smaller red tape and all that kind of stuff, greater individual freedoms and liberties. And that really has an impact on workers' rights and the unions. And where, half of Australians or more were in the union in the early 80s, now we're seeing around 15% of workers in their union. And it's even less for those who are younger. So as we're seeing, more boomers retire who are very heavily unionised and being replaced by those younger than us, younger than them, we are seeing, a drop in union rates. And that is directly, obviously, correlated with a decrease in workers' rights and in salary, because the union is there to fight for the rights of workers. They are to protect us from the, egregious excesses of capitalism, and to ensure that workers not only receive a fair wage and a fair pay, but have good rights and have safe workplaces. And though we don't think of universities as, the coal mine or a building site where you have those physical risks, there are actually a lot of risks in the university workplace. A lot of those are psychosocial, and that has drastic impacts on the physical as well. And so we are seeing, the increase of those kinds of harms and violence being done to workers. And basically, I think why we're seeing an increase in unionisation, despite what I've just said about the last 40 years, is because we're realising that doing nothing gets us nowhere, that not being in a union, not working collectively, harms us as workers, and that it is us against the bosses, that we need to fight together, we are stronger together, and hopefully we can make change in that way. So I hope that's a bit of hope there. Obviously, everything's quite a bit doom and gloom around the world and in the workplace, but I think there is hope in solidarity, and there is hope in collective action, and I think that is also something we're seeing around the world in response to rising fascism in response to, you know, late-stage capitalism and neoliberalism that is eroding the good life as we know it. The hope is that we will fight against that and together make those better changes.
So clearly there's a lot going on at Monash University campus to push back against these changes. Is there anything that can be done in the broader Melbourne or Australian community to support Monash's staff and to support the NTU?
Yeah, so if the public want to help us in our fight for this, and you know, to fight for workers' rights in the university and for, most importantly, the quality of student education, you can follow the branch social media for updates and more info on how you can help. So we have an Instagram account, NTU Monash branch, and we also have a Blue Sky account, a very newly opened Blue Sky, as well as Twitter and Facebook accounts as well. And we post on all of those, so you can see the regular updates. And, I mean, things are kind of winding down for the rest of the year because we are going into the holiday season. But next year, things will kick back up again and we'll be back on the fight. So if you want to help us then, it would be great, again, to follow our socials and see, you know, the call-outs we have there. But also it'd be great to put pressure on management, to put pressure on the vice chancellor and to spread the word about what is happening to, you know, not only staff and workers' rights, but to student education. And if you have kids in university, tell them about it so they can help also fight with us, alongside us, for our better working conditions. As they always say in the union, in the NTU at least, staff conditions are student learning conditions. And therefore, what affects us in our jobs has an impact on students and their education. And that is why we should fight together.